My name is Josiah Blackwood. This is the first record that I write at the instruction of Governor Endicott, who now requires all constables within the Massachusetts jurisdiction to maintain a faithful accounting of their duties. Though Exeter stands apart from the Bay Colony in many ways, we abide by their ordinances in matters of law and order. I will hold fast to this practice, seeing the worth in preserving the truth of events for those who follow after. I will inscribe each week's happenings in this leather-bound volume, marking the mundane and the troublesome alike with equal care. The ink is dear, purchased at no small expense from Portsmouth, but a constable's record must be kept in more than mere memory. I know not who might read these pages in years hence, so I feel I must set down some small account of our settlement. Exeter, now in its 18th year since founding, came to be through the exile of Reverend John Wheelwright and his faithful congregation. They, having been cast forth from Massachusetts for matters of conscience and doctrine, sought a place to worship as they deemed right. We number but 250 souls, a count that includes the scattered farmsteads that lie beyond our center. A modest count compared to Salem or Boston, yet each year brings new families seeking their portion in the wilderness. They build their homes of good pine timber, clear fields from the forest, and add their strength to our community. The wilderness presses close upon us, and the Penacook tribes still dwell within a day's journey, but we maintain peaceable relations with them, having purchased our lands fairly through proper covenant. Our position breeds certain hardships that the larger settlements do not face. The Squamscott River, while vital to our mills, can rise with fearsome speed during the spring thaws, threatening to carry away our livelihood. The road to Portsmouth, such as it is, becomes treacherous with mud in spring and nearly impassable when the winter snow lie deep. In times of trouble, we must look to our own devices, for aid from other settlements may be days in coming. The truth of this isolation was never more apparent than during the great fire of 53. I had departed for Portsmouth that morning on matters of trade, only to spy an ominous glow against the evening sky as I made my return. My heart seized at the sight, for I knew well that such light could mean nothing but a disaster for our settlement. I arrived to find a quarter of our dwellings already claimed by the flame. The fire seemed to have begun in Thomas Cooper's barn, although we know not its true origin. Our bucket lines proved useless against such fury. It was young William Brewster who conceived our salvation, though I confess I thought him mad when he first spoke of it. Having spent years working in the sawmill, he knew that the great water wheel could be modified to direct its flow. With the help of John Hayes and Peter Folsom, we worked in desperate haste to adjust the wheel's mechanisms, redirecting the mill's stream power through hastily assembled wooden channels to cast water upon the flames. The effort nearly claimed our lives. The heat warped our channels, and twice we had to rebuild them as the flames pressed ever closer. Yet, by God's grace and mortal desperation, we managed to hold the fire at bay long enough for the wind to shift. When dawn finally broke, half our settlement lay in ashes, but we had saved the rest. 37 souls were called to heaven that night, including my beloved Margaret. She had rushed into the Carpenter family's home to save their youngest child, only to have the burning timbers collapse upon them both. I find some small comfort in knowing she died as she lived, putting others first before herself, though the memory of her loss still burns deeper than any flame. Now, as winter's grip settles upon Exeter, I find my grief growing sharper with each passing frost. The morning chill no longer yields to afternoon sun, and ice forms in thick hollows around the mill wheels, requiring the miller boys to break it free thrice daily with long poles. These shortened days weigh heavily upon our settlement, more so this year than any I can recall. The loss of both Dr. Morrison and Reverend Dalton within a fortnight of each other has left a void that cannot easily be filled. Their absence has thrust additional duties upon my shoulders. Where once I concerned myself primarily with matters of law and order, I now find myself attending to tasks that would normally fall to more learned men. I have taken to carrying the doctor's book of simple remedies, though I profess no true healing knowledge beyond what any man might glean from careful reading. When illness strikes, I do what I can with herbs, praying my efforts not worsen God's judgment upon the afflicted. More troubling still are the spiritual duties that fall to me as one of the few remaining men of letters. Though I would never presume to deliver a proper sermon, I have been called upon to read scripture at births and deaths, to offer prayer when no more qualified voice is present. My father's training as a minister, though I did not follow his path, serves me well in these moments. The town council has written to Cambridge, requesting both a physician and a minister. But with winter's approach, we cannot expect new arrivals until spring's thaw. Until then, we must preserve as best we can, each bearing more than his customary share of duties. I must confess, though it pains my conscience to do so, that there remains some uncertainty regarding the final fate of Dr. Morrison. While we count him among the dead, having been absent these past days, no man among us has seen proof of his passing. On the evening of the 1st of November, Thomas Waterley, who kept a farmstead near the great pine marked by lightning, came pounding upon my door. His youngest son of just 9, Nathaniel, he told me had taken grievously ill, retching up bile black as pitch. Dr. Morrison, hearing Mr. Waterley's desperate account, gathered his medicines without delay, and they departed just as darkness was settling. That was the last Annie and Exeter laid eyes upon our physician. When a week passed without word, I grew troubled. John Bournemouth, whose skills at woodcraft exceed my own, agreed to accompany me to the Waterley farmstead. His talents with knife and wood were well known in our settlement. The children in particular seemed drawn to him, forever begging for his intricately carved toys. Though I had seen him whittle with everything from delicate birds to fearsome beasts, it was his small wooden dolls that garnered the most attention, their tiny faces carved with an uncanny precision that gave me sometimes a pause. I had not ventured to the Waterley farmstead in nearly 3 years, and the forest path seemed less certain in my memory than I cared to admit. Before departing, I sought counsel with Sarah Pratt, our settlement's midwife, who had accompanied Dr. Morrison there 6 months past when young Nathaniel had taken ill with fever. She described the way with great precision. I considered asking Sarah to accompany us, but with Dr. Morrison gone, this remained our settlement's only source of healing knowledge. I could not in good conscience remove her from Exeter, where 3 women lay near their time, and old Mr. Peter struggled with winter fever. We made ready our provisions, but that very morning we planned to depart. The Lord saw fit to blanket our lands with the earliest snow any can recall. The drifts rose past our knees before midday, making the journey impossible for any who wished to return alive. It was not until the 15th day of November that the snows had settled enough for Mr. Bournemouth and myself to attempt the journey to the Waterley farmstead. The path that Sarah had plotted for us seemed somehow altered beneath winter's shroud. What we discovered there shall haunt my dreams until the day the Lord calls me home, though I fear even heaven's grace may not wash these images from my mind. In the yard before the house lay Timothy Waterley and his wife Susan, or what remained of them. The snow bore witness to their final moments, stained not merely red but black where their blood had frozen in the bitter cold. Timothy's torso lay twisted at an impossible angle, as though some great force had wrung him like a wet cloth, his spine protruding through flesh that had been peeled back like the skin of an orange. Susan's remains we found scattered in a grotesque circle, her limbs wrenched from their sockets with such violence that the bone endings appeared not broken but shredded, as though pulled apart by dozens of hands rather than torn by beast or blade. No wolf nor bear known to these woods could have rendered any human flesh in such a manner, for the cuts were too precise, too deliberate in their cruelty. Their limbs lay scattered about the bloody snow like kindling split for the fire. In places the flesh bore marks that resembled the imprints of small teeth. Mr. Bournemouth, whose steady nature I had always admired, turned from the scene and retched into the snow. I cannot fault him, for only my duties as constable kept me from doing the same. Within the house, upon his bed, we found young Nathaniel. Unlike his parents, his body remained whole, though life had long since fled. His face bore an expression of such terrible peace that seemed more mask than flesh. Most troubling were his small hands laid across his chest as though in prayer, yet stained dark with what at first took to be the black bile of his reported illness. But upon closer inspection, I noted that beneath those stains were strips of cloth, fragments of his father's distinctive waistcoat and his mother's dress, caught beneath his fingernails. The floor around his bed had footprints, black with that same substance, and led from the bed to the door and back again. Of Dr. Morrison, we found only his medicine bag, its contents strewn across the floorboards like scattered grain. The medicines themselves appeared untouched, though many of the glass vials lay broken. I gathered what remained of the medicines into his leather bag. Though I recognized yarrow and feverfew among the scattered herbs, most of the remedies were foreign to my understanding. Still, I carefully collected each vial and packet, knowing that I may yet be able to teach myself how to administer them. Mr. Bournemouth and I found ourselves faced with the most troublesome choice. The day grew short, and the thought of burning both bodies and building before nightfall seemed impossible. We might have sheltered within those blood-stained walls until morning to complete our grim task, but neither of us could bear the thought of passing dark hours in that place. The alternative meant leaving all as we found it, and returning when daylight might better serve our purpose. Yet this choice too carried its burden of shame, for it went against all Christian duty to leave the dead untended. In the end, our courage failed us. Though it pains me to confess such weakness, we chose to depart, promising each other that we would return on the morrow with proper tools for the burning. I cannot find it in my heart to judge our decision too harshly, or there was something in that house, something in the very air itself, that seemed to press upon the soul with dreadful weight. Mr. Bournemouth and I agreed that we would speak nothing of what we had witnessed here to any but a select few. Better to say only that we had found the family deceased, letting the winter snows keep their darker secrets for now. Some truths serve only to breed fearful hearts. Upon our return to the settlement, I sought immediately to consult with Reverend Dalton, for such matters as we witnessed surely required spiritual counsel. Yet when I approached the parsonage, I found it dark and empty, the hearth long since gone cold. Eleanor Peters, who keeps the house adjacent to the parsonage, related a troubling account. While we were departed, the Reverend had burst from his home in a state of great agitation. She observed him pacing before the meeting house, clutching his Bible to his chest and muttering words she could not make out. When approached by several concerned members of the congregation, he proved unable or perhaps unwilling to articulate what so disturbed his spirit. He would only shake his head and gesture frantically towards the northern woods, his usual eloquence reduced to incomplete phrases about darkness and the children. That very evening, without gathering any of his belongings or bidding farewell to his flock, Reverend Dalton departed Exeter on foot. Some say he took the road south towards Hampton, though in such weather, no man would expect to make this journey alive. The next morning, when I called upon Mr. Bournemouth to make ready for our return to the farmstead, I found him much altered. His hands shook as he cleaned his musket. He would not meet my gaze as he spoke of delays and obligations that now prevented him from joining me. When I pressed him, reminding him of our Christian duty, he confessed that without Reverend Dalton's presence to bless our endeavor, he dared not venture back to that accursed place. After much discourse and no small amount of strong spirits, he finally consented to accompany me on the 21st, 2 days from now, though his agreement seemed more born of shame than conviction. In the days that followed, I found myself called to attend 2 births, those of Samuel Wainwright and Rachel Underhill. Though I read from Scripture and offered what comfort I could, I thanked the Lord daily for Sarah Pratt's presence among us. Her skills as a midwife proved invaluable, for while I might stumble through a prayer, The delicate matter of bringing new life into this world lies far beyond my knowledge. Both children and mothers thrived under her experienced hand. I count it as one of God's mercies that we've not lost her, as we've lost the doctor and minister. Though these trials weigh heavily upon our settlement, I hold fast to my conviction that the Lord shall see us through. The people of Exeter possess a strength born of adversity. We who carved our homes from wilderness and weathered exile know well how to endure. While Dr. Morrison and Reverend Dolan's absences leave a void not easily filled, I have witnessed daily the resolve of our townspeople to support one another through these dark winter months. I have no doubt that we shall emerge from this season stronger, our bonds of community tested but unbroken. The Lord provides, even in our darkest hours. Written in faithful service to the Township of Exeter, Josiah Blackwood, Constable. From the log of Josiah Blackwood, 4th week of November, year of our Lord, 1656. The Lord has seen fit to grant Exeter an unseasonable warmth these past days, though I confess it brings me no comfort. While the bitter winds have temporarily retreated and the early snows have melted back to reveal the muddy earth, the affairs within our settlement grow colder. I record these events with a steady hand, though my spirit trembles. The weather, much like the strange occurrences I must document, defies the natural order that God, in His wisdom, have established. On the morning of the 21st of November, I made ready to accompany Mr. Bournemouth back to the Waterlay farmstead. A strange mist had settled upon Exeter that crept between the houses and clung to the ground like a burial shroud. As I gathered my equipment for the day in the dim light of the dawn, a fierce pounding shook my door. Upon opening it, I discovered Abigail Wainwright, her hair in wild disarray, her shoes caked with mud. Her eyes held such terror I had not witnessed since the wolf attacks last winter. The woman's hands clutched at my coat with shocking force as she beseeched my aid. Through her tears, she insisted that during the night, some presence had stolen into her home and exchanged her infant son for another. She swore with increasing hysteria that this was not her child. I reminded her of our Lord's commandment against bearing false witness, and suggested that perhaps her recent confinement had worn upon her constitution. Yet she would not be dissuaded, describing how the infant's cry had changed, how its eyes now held an awareness that no child of less than a week should possess. Though I believe this to be nothing more than night fears of an overtaxed mind, my duty as constable required that I investigate any claim that might threaten the peace of our settlement. I gathered my things and accompanied Abigail to her home, which lay on that western edge of the settlement near the mill pond. Upon entering, the mist seemed to follow us through the door like an unwelcome guest. Pritchard Wainwright stood near the hearth, his weathered face bearing an expression of both concern and embarrassment. He cast me an apologetic glance that spoke volumes about what his thoughts were regarding his wife's claims. I approached the crude cradle where young Samuel lay swaddled in linens. At first glance, nothing appeared amiss. The child slumbered peacefully, his chest rising and falling with the regularity God grants to all his innocent creatures. Yet as I stood watching, the child's eyes opened with a suddenness that caused me to step back. In all my years as constable, I had witnessed the calculating stares of murderers and thieves, have met the yellow gaze of wolves stalking a livestock, yet none had disturbed my soul as deeply as what I had beheld in that cradle. The infant's eyes held not a clouded, unfocused gaze of newborn children, but rather the sharp, known scrutiny of something far older. As I stood transfixed, the child's features shifted in a manner that sent a chill through my very marrow. Its tiny mouth curled with deliberate purpose, forming an expression that spoke of ancient malevolence rather than innocent hunger. Such awareness should not, could not exist in one so newly delivered into God's world. I pushed these thoughts aside, as they were unworthy of a man charged with maintaining order. Drawing Pritchard away from where his wife stood, I spoke to him in low tones of my pressing business at the Waterlay farm. I warned him that should his wife's hysteria continue to threaten the peace of our godly settlement, I would have no choice but to confine her to the panic room until such time as her senses might be restored. See that she rests, I told him firmly, and ensure this matter stays within your household. With those words, I took my leave, though I must admit the memory of those infant eyes followed me into the mist. John Bournemouth awaited me at the edge of the settlement with his cart already loaded with pitch and kindling. We exchanged shallow nods, both knowing the grim task that lay before us at the Waterlay farm. Mr. Bournemouth spoke little on our trip, save to comment on the unseasonable warmth, and I was grateful for this silence. The tools of our burning work rattled against the cart's wooden sides with each bump and rut we crossed. We arrived at the farm, and the sight that greeted us was no less horrific than days prior. The torn remains of Timothy and Susan Wanderlay lay where we had found them, now bearing the marks of time's cruel passage. With grim determination, Mr. Bournemouth and I set about our solemn task. We gathered the scattered pieces of God's children, limbs and flesh that no earthly power could make whole again. The building of the pyre took considerable effort, for the wood must be stacked just so to ensure a proper burning. We laid pitch-soaked kindling between layers of split logs, constructing a platform that would serve as a family's finally earthly vessel. The unseasonable warmth caused sweat to bead upon our brows, despite the gravity of our labor. When the pyre stood ready, we turned our attention to collecting young Nathaniel from within the home. Upon entering the boy's chamber, we found the bed as we'd left it, yet something was amiss. The bed was empty. We pulled back the covers to confirm what our eyes had already told us, finding only the impression where the boy's body had lain. No track or trace suggested how Nathaniel's corpse had been moved, and none had been given authority to do so. Mr. Bournemouth and I searched every corner of that cursed house, though we knew the futility of our efforts. No corpse could rise and walk away of his own accord, yet neither could we deny the evidence before us. The boy was gone. With heavy hearts, we returned to our grim duty. The pyre received Timothy and Susan's mortal remains. I spoke the words of committal as flames reached heavenward. The unseasonable warmth seemed to feed the fire's hunger, and soon there remained nothing but ash. Our next task was equally bleak. We splashed the lamp oil in careful patterns throughout the house, ensuring no room would escape the cleansing fire. When all was prepared, I cast my torch through the window. The flames took hold with surprising speed, as if some spirit of destruction had been waiting for this moment. Mr. Bournemouth and I stood in silence as the house was consumed, watching the hungry flames devour the last earthly traces of the Waterlay family. When our work was complete, the sun had already risen high above the tree line. Before leaving, I pulled Mr. Bournemouth aside regarding young Nathaniel's disappearance. Though his countenance betrayed deep misgivings, my firm reminder of the panic such news might spark in Exeter swayed him to discretion. He nodded his reluctant assent, and we left that place with our burden of secrets weighing heavily upon us both. On the muddy road leading back to the settlement, we encountered Weary Moon of the Penacook people. I had known him through his occasional trading visits to our settlement. He stood in our path, his normally stoic demeanor marked by an unusual agitation. "We hunt Great Bear," he said in his broken English, gesturing towards the dense forest. "It killed two of my people." I pressed him further about the nature of these deaths, but my questions exceeded his grasp of our tongue. When I inquired whether any of his tribe had entered the Waterlay house, he shook his head with evident conviction. As we watched Weary Moon depart, Mr. Bournemouth muttered that we'd do better to watch the natives than whatever beasts they claimed to hunt, for they had likely brought this evil upon themselves. Though I had heard such a sentiment before from others in our settlement, I had found the Penacook to be honest in their dealings, if different in their ways. Mr. Bournemouth and I remained watchful on our return journey, yet we encountered nothing save the unsettling warmth and encroaching darkness. Upon reaching Exeter's bounds, The townsfolk's eyes fell heavy upon us, as if we had carried the scent of what we had just witnessed. Though the flames had granted some measure of peace to the waterlays, the matter of their missing son gnaws at my conscience like a rat in the granary. I've done my duty in burning what remained, yet the completion of my task feels as hollow as the empty bed we discovered. Some threads, it seems, refuse to be tied neatly. Josiah Blackwood, Constable. From the log of Josiah Blackwood, first week of December, year of our Lord, 1656. The changing of months has brought no relief to our troubled settlement. This year's darkening days have carried with them a weight I cannot rightly name. The strange occurrences that have plagued our township these past months shows no signs of abating with the season. I had thought at least we had been spared the necessity of employing the panic room these past 2 years. The last poor soul confined therein had been young Thomas Wheeler, whose mind had been temporarily possessed by some fever of the brain. The chamber itself stands as a testament to Exeter's changing fears. In our first years, we dug an underground refuge beneath the meeting house, a place to shelter our women and children should relations with the native people turn hostile. Though we purchased our lands fairly from the Penacook and have maintained peace, the memories of conflicts further south kept fresh our fears. The first chamber, dark and earth-walled, served its intended purpose but once, when a war party from an unknown tribe passed near our bounds. It was the fever of 52 that gave us cause to repurpose our defenses. When that burning sickness swept through our settlement, it left some of our number possessed by violent spirits, requiring confinement for both their safety and ours. Yet the underground chamber proved ill-suited, its damp air only worsened their condition. Under Reverend Dalton's guidance, we constructed this new room adjacent to the meeting house, above ground where fresh air might better serve those confined within. It was built of thick pine timbers with a single iron-barred window and a door that could be secured against any force the afflicted might bring to bear. Scripture verses were carved into the door frame, and a heavy wooden cross hung opposite the door, modest safeguards against whatever darkness might possess a person's spirit. It was near the midnight hour on the 1st of December when cries from without stirred me from my rest. Taking up my staff and badge, I ventured into the bitter night air where I spied several figures huddled near the meeting house. Upon circling to the rear of the building, I discovered Pritchard Wainwright and three others gathered outside the panic room, its heavy door sealed shut. Without a word to the gathered men, I raised myself upon toes to peer through the narrow window. The moonlight filtering through the iron-crossed opening revealed Abigail Wainwright, huddled in the furthest corner. Her form was twisted strangely, head pressed against the rough-hewn planks, her fingers working relentlessly at the wood grain, as though attempting to burrow through by nail alone. I found myself rounding upon Pritchard, my anger rising at this unauthorized use of the panic room. Yet as I nay to rebuke him for taking such liberties without the constable's leave, he spoke first, telling of how Abigail herself had fled into the chamber, pleading through tears for them to secure the locks. Though my anger did not fully subside, I felt my tongue stilled. Pritchard's eyes held mine in silent supplication. I did not need his words to tell me he wanted me to speak with Abigail. Though every instinct counseled me against disturbing one who had willingly sought such confinement, my duty as constable could not be denied. I cast one final glance at the assembled men before approaching the door, knowing full well it remained unlatched, as I alone possessed the only key that could secure its locks. I entered with measured steps, though the sound still caused Abigail to start. Her fingernails were bloodied from their assault upon the wall, and she pressed herself further into the corner at my approach. I waited a long moment, letting a silence settle before asking her purpose in seeking refuge here. She spoke of young Nathaniel Waterlay, dead these past 3 weeks, standing over her infant Samuel's cradle in the deepest night, More disturbing still was her insistence that her son, not yet having reached his first month of life, had been speaking with the boy. I spoke with perhaps more force than wisdom, reminding her that I had witnessed young Nathaniel's lifeless form with my own eyes. Further, her son Samuel had scarce drawn breath for 2 weeks. He could no more form words than the stones themselves. Abigail offered no defense of her claims, but declared with dreadful certainty that she would not return to her dwelling while Samuel remained within. My rebuke came harsh and swift, for such talk could kindle dangerous fears within our settlement. I warned her that spreading such tales would sow needless terror among the good wives of Exeter. I knew with grim inevitability that I must act swiftly and decisively to prevent such darkness from taking root. I told Abigail with firm resolve that I would examine young Samuel myself again, though I held little doubt I would find anything but a normal child. She made no reply. With swift purpose, I strode into the Wainwright dwelling. The windows glowed with candlelight despite the late hour. Upon entering, I discovered Sarah Pratts, our midwife, already in attendance. She gestured toward the back of the room where Samuel lay, informing me in hushed tones that the infant slumbered peacefully in his cradle. Before approaching Samuel, I turned to Sarah. Having attended the birth and tended to both mother and child these past weeks, her judgment carried the weight of experience. When questioned about any peculiarities in the infant's nature, she spoke with the measured certainty I had come to value in her profession, describing only the ordinary challenges of a newborn child. No fits, no strange marks, nothing to suggest anything but proper health. Her steady presence and clear-minded observations provided some small comfort amidst the growing shadows of uncertainty. In these troubled times, such reliable voices helped anchor our community against the tides of fearful fancy. I approached Samuel's cradle, mindful of each board beneath my feet. The infant lay in peaceful repose, his tiny chest rising and falling with the steady rhythm of innocent sleep. His small fingers were curled into soft fists, and his features showed nothing of the disturbances that so afflicted his mother. Turning back to Sarah, I inquired after Abigail's health these past weeks. The midwife's expression softened as she spoke of the trials of all new mothers endure. The sleepless nights, the strains upon both body and spirit. Her gentle defense of Abigail's state pricked at my conscience, for I recalled with shame the harshness of my earlier words. I thought perhaps I had been too quick to judge, too eager to maintain order at the expense of compassion. Sarah seemed to perceive my inner struggle, for her weathered features softened further. Her words brought unexpected solace as she spoke of my burden, how I served not merely as constable, but as physician to our settlement's fears and shepherd to their troubled spirits. She stated that I was the only thing that was stopping her from watching us all burn, and I felt the weight of my duty anew. I muttered my thanks, touched by her understanding of the lonely path I now walk. After long contemplation, I resolved to grant Abigail her refuge for the night's remainder. The panic room would serve well enough as a sanctuary, its door left purposely unlatched should she choose to depart. Come morning's light, I would address her fears with a clearer mind, and God willing, gentler tongue than I had shown this night. Such were my plans for the morrow, yet dawn brought fresh horrors before I could act upon them. The first rays of morning light had scarce touched my window when Mary Underhill's frantic pounding roused me from my fitful sleep. Her words spilled forth in desperate haste, speaking of black bile issuing from her infant Rachel's mouth. I now made for their dwelling, steeling myself for what affliction I might find. There lay young Rachel, not yet a month in this world, with dark bile seeping from her tiny lips. Most unsettling was not the foul substance itself, but the child's demeanor, for she smiled and cooed as though at play, tiny hands grasping for the air, while that black corruption trickled down her chin. I stumbled back into the bitter morning air. The first soul I encountered, though their face now escapes my recollection, I dispatched with urgent haste to fetch Sarah Pratts. I then entered Dr. Morrison's abandoned office. Among the dusty shelves and scattered papers, I located the medical bag recovered from the Wainwright farm. Inside, I found those same black herbs, gathering them carefully into a pouch. Though a stack of the doctor's notes caught my eye, their volume proved to be too great for proper study in such pressing moments. I took only the herbs. Returning to the Underhill dwelling, I found Sarah Pratt's already bent over young Rachel's cradle. Without word or hesitation, I presented the herbs recovered from Dr. Morrison's bag, confessing my ignorance of their proper use. Sarah's weathered hands moved with practiced certainty, taking the dark leaves and crushing them between her fingers. She mixed the herbs with water in a manner I'd witnessed Dr. Morrison employ during her accompaniment of his rounds. The effects proved swift and remarkable. As Sarah administered the mixture, Rachel's dark emissions ceased, the child's previously unnatural demeanor settling into proper infant slumber. I watched in silent amazement as color returned to her tiny features, all trace of the black corruption vanishing as though it had never been. When I inquired of Sarah about the nature of the herbs, she fixed me with a penetrating gaze. "Such remedies must be employed only by those who know their proper use," she stated, her tone leaving no room for further question. I resolved then to study Dr. Morrison's volumes when time permitted, so that I might better understand these mysterious cures. As I pen these words by candlelight, our settlement stands vulnerable without Dr. Morrison's guidance or Reverend Dalton's spiritual counsel. Responsibility falls heavy upon those who remain, poor substitutes though we may be. Yet we have no choice but to endure. These dark occurrences, coming so early in winter's grip, leave me with grave doubts about our capacity to weather what lies ahead. Still, like those who first carved Exeter from the wilderness, we must persist with what knowledge and faith we possess. Josiah Blackwood, Constable. From the log of Josiah Blackwood, second week of December, year of our Lord, 1656. In my office as constable, I have witnessed much that tests the mettle of a God-fearing man, yet never have my duties as a lawman been so sorely tried as in these past days. The memories weigh heavy, like a lead in my chest, but they must be preserved, lest the others dismiss them as mere winter tales. The settlement of Exeter shall never be as it was before the events I must now commit to these pages. Let it be known that what follows is the true and complete account of what transpired during this fearful week. The fourth day of December found me within Dr. Morrison's abandoned study, a chamber thick with dust and the musty breath of neglected volumes. Though the good doctor had vanished, his work and notes remained, scattered leaves of testimony that I hoped might shed light upon our present tribulations. I lit a tallow candle, its flame casting wild shadows across the shelves of medical texts and journals. The doctor's hand, normally so precise, grew increasingly agitated in his later entries. I traced my finger across the pages, reading accounts that chilled me more thoroughly than the December wind. Young Thomas Wheeler, age 6, read one entry from early spring. Brought hence by his mother, showing signs most peculiar, the boy refuses sustenance these 3 past days, yet maintains his vigor. In fits, his small frame arches like a bow, limbs rigid as hickory. The mother swears upon her Bible that she witnessed him suspend above his bed, though I cannot credit such a thing. More cases followed, the Cooper twins with their eyes rolled back, speaking in tongues no Christian soul should utter. Mary Sampson's daughter who vomited pins, young Peter Wingate who climbed his walls like a spider in the night. Each account more disturbing than the last, yet none had reached my ears in the capacity as constable. What seized my attention most forcefully was the timing. These afflictions began precisely when Sarah Pratt's took up her position assisting the doctor. At first, Morrison's notes spoke highly of Sarah's skill with herbs in her patience with children, yet as the years and months wore on, his praise turned to suspicion. "I mark how the children sicken after Sarah's treatments," he wrote in trembling script. "Though she claims to ease their sufferings, their illnesses grow stranger still. I have observed her muttering over the beds, not prayers as she claims, but words that cause my very soul to shudder. God forgive me, I fear I have allowed a wolf among the lambs." I turned the brutal pages with growing unease until I came upon an entry dated mere days before Morrison's disappearance. The ink was fresh enough that I could still detect its iron-like scent upon the paper. "I have journeyed to the Waterlay farmstead alone," Morrison wrote. "I dare not let Sarah Pratt attend me here, as is her custom. The boy Nathaniel's affliction weighs heavily upon my conscience, for I fear her presence has only worsened his condition." The entry continued, "Young Nathaniel speaks with a voice not his own, deep and hollow. He raves of murderous intentions towards his parents, though the Waterlays are good, God-fearing folk, who have shown him nothing but Christian love. When I press him about these dark thoughts, he raves that only the flames can grant him death, and that no other means will suffice." The boy repeated this thrice, each time in that terrible voice that seemed to echo from the very pit of hell. The doctor's normally precise script grew increasingly erratic as the entry continued. "I had witnessed him scratching strange marks into the floorboards with his fingernails until they bleed. His mother discovered similar markings beneath his bed, burned into the wood as if by some unholy fire. When I attempted to pray over him, he began to laugh, such a laugh as I pray to never hear again in this mortal world. I wish I could claim it was my duty as constable that drove my actions this night, but in truth, it was a rage born of righteousness that set my feet upon Sarah Pratt's doorstep. I found her tending her hearth, and without ceremony or warrant, I seized her by the neck of her dress. Her protest echoed through Exeter as I dragged her struggling form across the muddy ground. Though she scratched and fought like a wild animal, my grip loosened not. The townsfolk emerged from their homes like pale moths drawn to the flame, but none dared interfere as I hauled her toward the meeting house. They knew my office, trusted my judgment, yet I saw fear in their eyes. I threw her into the panic room with such force she stumbled against the far wall. In the dim light filtering through that narrow window, I confronted her with Morrison's journals, with the children's afflictions, and with young Nathaniel's terrible fate. I accused her of bringing devil's work to Exeter, my voice trembling with barely contained fury. My demands for her to confess her wickedness echoed off the panic room's wooden walls. Sarah's lips curled into a smile that held no mirth, only malice. She began to laugh, a sound like dead leaves scraping across unmarked graves. Before my very eyes, her features seemed to shift and age, as if years were passing in mere moments. The rage that consumed me in that moment should have given way to terror, yet it did not. I reached into my coat and withdrew the small leather pouch of herbs. Through the iron-barred window, I could smell its contents, a foul mixture of black powder, crushed leaves, what appeared to be dried mushroom caps. "What devil's brew is this?" I demanded, thrusting the pouch through the window's narrow opening and emptying its contents into her face. "Speak true, or by God's grace I shall see you swing before a week's end." My threats only seemed to feed her mirth. Her laughter grew wilder, more unnatural, echoing off the oak plank walls in ways that defied sense. When at last she spoke, her voice carried an edge that cut deeper than any winter wind. "No, not what you hold, constable," she wheezed between fits of laughter. "These be the ashes of those who burned in 53. The fire gives power to those who know its use." Just as my fingers grasped the iron handle to confront her further, a hellish glow caught my eye through the meeting house window. I turned to witness an impossible sight. The forest edge had erupted into a wall of flame that reached towards the heavens themselves. The fire moved with an unnatural purpose, as though guided by some unseen hand. There, silhouetted against the inferno, stood several small figures, children, still as death, watching the fire with unblinking eyes. My blood ran cold as Sarah's laughter echoed through the panic room behind me, mixing with the growing roar of the flames. The fire spread with supernatural speed, leaping from tree to tree and then the outlying buildings of our settlement. My duties as constable took hold. I left Sarah to her mad cackling and ran into the street, calling for evacuation. The settlement's wooden buildings, dry by winter's chill, would offer no resistance to such a fire. The screams of awakening townsfolk filled the air as smoke began to choke the streets of Exeter. I ran, calling out to sleeping souls, pounding upon doors with my constable's staff. Yet amidst the growing chaos, my steps faltered. There, illuminated by the hellish glow, stood young Nathaniel Waterlay. My mind recoiled from the impossibility before me. Not 3 weeks passed, I had witnessed the boy's broken body laid in his bed, his flesh already bearing the marks of corruption. Yet here he stood, whole and unmarred, save for his eyes, black as pitch and reflecting the flames like polished obsidian. When he spoke, the voice that issued from his childish form bore no relation to the sweet-natured boy I had known. It resonated with the depth of a church bell tolling in the depths of some abysmal cavern. Though the inferno raged around us, neither he nor I moved, locked in a moment that seemed to stretch beyond the bounds of natural time. He spoke of a sacrifice interrupted, of rituals left incomplete due to my interference. Though his words touched my ears, they seemed to bypass my mind entirely, striking directly at my soul with their otherworldly pitch. After a pause that might have been at moments or hours, his terrible voice intoned, "In our endless dance with entropy, we must rescind our sentience. This is the sickness that we know." My limbs had turned to lead as he fixed me with those bottomless eyes.
"Watch us burn."
As if summoned by his words, fresh flames erupted from nearby buildings. The heat struck me like a physical blow, driving me backwards. Smoke seared my lungs and stung my eyes until I could scarcely see. I stumbled blindly, finding myself within the meeting house by either chance or some unseen guidance. Through streaming eyes, I spotted the iron ring set into the floorboards, the entrance to the original panic room, built beneath the earth in the settlement's earliest days. With trembling hands, I heaved it open, the hinges protesting. Without hesitation, I lowered myself into the space, pulling the trapdoor shut above me. Here, in this earthen chamber beneath Exeter's meeting house, I write by the guttering light of my constable's badge, its brass surface reflecting just enough of the inferno above to illuminate these pages. My staff lies beside me, useless now save as a prop to steady my trembling hand as I record these final testimonies. The screams above have grown fewer, yet more terrible. Sarah's laughter, which echoed through the wooden planks of the upper panic room, has transformed into shrieks that chill me more deeply than this underground air. Above it all, I hear children's voices raised in song, not the sweet hymns of our Sunday gatherings, but something older, darker, in words no Christian tongue should form. Smoke seeps through the seams of my refuge, and though the earth that surrounds me may preserve these pages, I hold no such hope for myself. The air grows thinner with each breath, and I smell the bitter tang of burning timber drawing ever nearer. These may well be my final words, scratched here in the darkness as Exeter burns above me. May God have mercy on those who find this account, and grant them the wisdom to heed its warnings. Josiah Blackwood, Constable.